This is Words First, talking text in opera. I'm Keturah Stickan. Talking to Stephanie Fleischman is like watching synapses be created. It's like watching the brief flash of a spark turn into a giant fire. She is the embodiment of passion and creative idea. It's so obvious when someone has a great love for the subject about which they speak. Stephanie oozes affection for writing, for music, and for the truly collaborative form of opera. I spoke with Stephanie 2 weeks ago about her libretti, and we mostly stuck to the works that are still in process, which is to say that this talented woman is on the brink of something amazing. Having written The Long Walk with Jeremy Howard Beck, with whom she was paired at the American Lyric Theater's Composer Librettist Development Program, she is now writing multiple pieces for multiple composers, and listening to her speak about both community engagement and creative process was ecstatic. Here is Stephanie Fleischman and myself in a conversation from August 4th, 2020. Stephanie, I am so happy to be talking to you today. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
You write across several mediums. Can you just tell me a little bit about your journey to the opera libretto?
Sure. So I grew up around classical music. My dad ran the Eller Philharmonic for 30 years. So there was always music in my house, and I went to concerts and grew up knowing some of the great classical musicians of our times. But I didn't see very much opera at all. And did see a lot of plays. So mm-hmm. when I went to college, my mom is an architect. So I guess I have this strong visual side, and then I have this strong musical side.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
And so I studied photography in college, and I got pretty serious. I also did set design. So I feel like those things were informing my writing. And then I started to write plays in college. I started exploring the form of theater. I was not a theater major. I was an English major. So I was obsessed with language and literary texts. And then when I got into the world, I lived with a musician from the knitting factory downtown, mm-hmm. kind of music world. And we started writing art songs together. And then we started writing a music theater work. And as I continued to explore sort of the world of theater, music was just always part of whatever I wrote.
Mm-hmm.
I just had this sort of glimmer, this kind of, I didn't know what it was. I'm still new to opera, but I knew that I wanted to try writing operas. And mm-hmm. There was this very kind of funny moment where Esa-Pekka Salonen was thinking of writing an opera. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, and I was so excited to have a meeting with him. And the meeting never happened, because I think that he was afraid that if he didn't feel like this was the right collaboration, or if we started the collaboration, it didn't go well. My father, who basically sort of discovered him and who was a dear friend, would be devastated.
Right.
So I sort of stayed away from opera as long as my father was alive, actually. And I would say to him, you know, I think I might want to write opera. And he would say, why would you want to do a thing like that? There's no money in it. And I'd be like, Dad, there's no money in theater. And I think what he meant was that the librettist, you know, is not necessarily considered the primary artist.
Right.
And he was thinking of me as someone who needed to be that. And or he wanted me to be that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was actually after he passed away, in the months after he passed away, I applied for American Lyric Theater.
Right.
And I got in, and we started about 6 months after he had left us, and it was an amazing training. And I was kind of privately grieving my dad through all of the listening that we were doing and all of the mm-hmm. talking we were doing about music. And that was really the beginning. And I don't know if anyone has talked about American Lyric Theater on the podcast.
Quite a few, yeah. It's been really interesting to hear so many people bring it up. But I'm fascinated by this notion of training librettists, because it's something that I think gets neglected a little bit. And I think ALT has really made great forward strides with it. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that... I mean, the way that it works is that you're listening and kind of being exposed to various elements of the canon. So you're being exposed to what opera is, and you're being asked to experiment with the different sort of, an aria or an ensemble or recit. And you're collaborating with four, or now I think it's three, there are three and three, and then there's two dramaturgs. But so you're collaborating with all the composers. Every librettist is collaborating with every composer. Mm-hmm. And then ultimately they pair you with the person they think will either challenge you the most or is the best fit for the longer project at the end, the Opera in Eden project, which is an interesting exercise, almost in paint by numbers, that Mark Adamo invented, where there's no way you cannot write something that is actually dramatic. Mm. Like, he's kind of made it fail-proof in that way.
Interesting.
And I was paired with Jeremy Howard Beck, and that was a really, promising collaboration. And so after that, unless something terrible goes wrong, they commission you to write a full-length piece.
Cool.
And so Larry Adelson commissioned Jeremy and I to write something, and that first project, The Long Walk, mm-hmm. Was really what got me started. And I have to say also that, Larry and my other mentors at ALT, Corey Ellison mm-hmm. and Mark Campbell and Mark Adamo, they've been so incredibly supportive. And what I found, is that opera is a smaller world. And I've just been able to make my way really quickly from that kind of launching pad mm-hmm. because of the support of in large part because of the support of those people.
That's
and
great.
And the exposure. I mean, the other thing that I would say that brings me to opera is working in theater and teaching playwriting and being a dramaturg on certain projects mm-hmm. and working with certain directors as a kind of a collaborator, not necessarily as the playwright, but as a collaborator, and really getting inside the architectonics of the theatrical space and uh-huh. what the music of the theatrical space,
right.
And the potential of that. And I think that there's, so much to be learned in terms of all the elements, passage of time and character and space and punctuation and exploring different worlds and the potential for stylizing and also getting having experience with incredible actors, so that now when I'm working with singers, they're the ones that are just the sort of creatures of the theater, the amazing singing actors. And I remember my first moment realizing that singers could be, as profoundly embody a character as profoundly as a theater actor.
I love that the bio on your website says that you are an award-winning librettist and playwright whose texts serve as blueprints for intricate three-dimensional sonic and visual worlds. That's such a descriptive image. But in terms of talking about collaboration that you were, I actually was thinking about the idea of a play or a libretto being a blueprint. Is that how you see your work as a whole, like a series of blueprints?
Yes and no. I mean, I think that as a collab, like when I'm making a new work, I am creating a blueprint, and I both have very specific ideas about it and also a great deal of openness, so that I hope kind of invites collaborators in. And yet, you know, when a work is being done for the first time, I'm incredibly involved.
Right.
I can't help but be incredibly involved somehow.
Well, I actually even loved just, I mean, thank you for the opportunity to peruse a few of your libretti, because it was just so interesting to see just the way that you, they were all laid out slightly differently, but you, there's this inherent musicality to them. And I love that within the work, you talk about where you see things repeating, where you expect people to sing over each other. There you have notes about whether or not somebody's voice, somebody should be activated via song in various places. And do you find yourself, when you're in a collaborative process with a composer, always this specific with the musical structure of the piece, or does it truly depend on who you're writing with?
I think it's both. I think that the work changes radically depending on who I'm writing with, mm-hmm. and what they need and what you know, our exchange kind of produces. Mm-hmm. I often make suggestions, or I know that we need overlapping for whatever, you know, we need two people singing for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. And I will always have ideas of where the text should fall in the music, but that always changes, mm-hmm. as well. Like, mm-hmm. like it's kind of like a suggestion that then obviously shifts so greatly once its music is set to the words, or although there have been times when I've also written words to music. So
interesting. So how often does that happen, that you find that the music comes first?
Very infrequently, but with Popea that I'm working on with Michael Hirsch, mm-hmm. when he approached me, he had written a scene, and he'd actually written sort of dummy lyrics for the scene. Uh-huh. And then we structured the story we wanted to tell together, and I started to write. But he was writing so fast, because he's such a mad genius, that he was like, I'm going to write these scenes, because we had a very detailed outline. I'm going to write these scenes. I know you haven't gotten to them yet, but don't worry, you don't need to set them. Mm. You know, you don't need to write words to them. And I was like, great. I'm sure that music will really inform what I write. So mm-hmm. please, like, share it with me.
So let's actually get into depth about some of your work. Let's talk a little more about The Pigeon Keeper. So this is your second collaboration with David Hanlon. I know David from HGOCO, and I believe that you met there as well with After the Storm. Was that your first work with him?
Yes.
Is Pigeon Keeper an original story?
Yes, it is.
Can you talk a little bit about the piece, or what the inspiration for the work was with him?
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. So with After the Storm for HGOCO, that was an idea that he came to me with and had already proposed to HGOCO, and actually was also an original story, but he had proposed that we adapt this book that ultimately HGOCO didn't get the rights to, that uh-huh. was about the Great Storm. Uh-huh. So we were like, they said, well, you have 2 weeks to come up with something new. and so we did, and we came up with an idea, and they said, that sounds like an oratorio. And so we were, you know, manically kind of trying to generate a story. And also, Matthew Ozawa was part of that process, mm-hmm. And on the project, like from the moment that I was on it. Mm-hmm. So the three of us really developed that together, and it was a great collaboration, and it was really exciting to do the research where we, it was about the Great Storm of 1900 in Galveston, Texas. Uh-huh. So we made several field trips to Galveston, and we did a libretto reading for some of the people that we had interviewed, mm-hmm. A very small kind of private audience. And we just shared like the first half of the libretto with them. And it was an amazing experience because they all kind of saw and felt themselves reflected in the text.
Oh, interesting.
And so it was very moving, in fact. And so we made this piece that we think is really tremendous, but because it's HGO Co, which, and Song of Houston, mm-hmm. And because we didn't have like press reps or anything, the rest of the opera world thinks that is, it's just a local story, and they don't, it's hard for people to understand that actually it's a universal story, and it's about, it really is about climate change, and it's about how human beings put themselves in the face of great danger mm-hmm. because of extreme weather, basically, and how people cleave to, you know, places that they call home, right. No matter what. And so we were a little disappointed that it, you know, that that's how the world kind of viewed it, other than, you know, the audiences in Galveston and Houston. And I know that HGO was like thrilled with the piece. And so we set out with The Pigeon Keeper. We decided we wanted to make a piece that was like clearly not a fairy tale exactly, but something that wasn't, that although we wanted it to be incredibly urgent, that couldn't be kind of ghettoized into a like a timely issue that then passed.
Right.
Or we wanted to make something that people would understand immediately, spoke to any time, all times, and all people, basically. And so I wanted to do something about refugees, and I had spent a lot of time in Greece and in Italy, and I was really interested in what happened to those people who, you know, went on boats from Africa to Italy, and how the, or to Greece, and how the, I think I was really inspired by a particular New York Times film about the Coast Guard and how they saw it as their mission to save these people, and what happened when people weren't saved, or how villages actually welcomed the refugees that were crossing from Macedonia on down. And so together we kind of brainstormed what this more universal kind of almost fairy tale or fable-esque piece could be that would tap into these kinds of ideas. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to make it an imaginary place, an imaginary island. But again, it was interesting because with the libretto reading, Corey Ellison, who's the dramaturg on the project, she I had asked that maybe somebody who was Greek could come.
Mm-hmm.
And so she invited a Greek opera singer. I'm forgetting his name right now, but I had never met him. And he spoke afterwards, and he said, this completely captures the psyche and the spirit of this very specific place in Greece, Mani, which is a very kind of barren or landscape that's very intense. And I just felt very happy with that.
But that's a little bit of a win, huh?
yeah. But that's how it came about. And also, you know, Opera for All Voices is very specifically, we actually didn't understand when we generated the idea that for all voices didn't necessarily mean for kids. But so we wanted to do something for all ages.
Got it.
And David has two young daughters, and it's been kind of exciting to see them involved in the process.
Oh, right.
Along the way. Yeah.
Yeah. Very cool. When does Pigeon Keeper, or when is it supposed to, it hasn't premiered yet, correct?
It hasn't premiered. We were supposed to have a music workshop in May, and that is now rescheduled for a year from then. The exciting thing about the delay is that gave us time to form a partnership with the San Francisco Girls Chorus.
Oh, yes. I've worked with them. They're wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah. So hopefully next May we will be workshopping it in San Francisco. I think it's still a bit in process whether it will premiere in Santa Fe in 22 or perhaps in San Francisco mm-hmm. or perhaps somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And I think that the idea is that that will come of the music workshop,
sure.
that the consortium members will sort of respond to what we've made then
right.
and decide to jump on board or not. So, but it's been, I don't know, it's a piece that we both feel very passionately about and we're both very excited about.
That's great. I also want to talk about writing. I mean, going back a little bit to sort of working for HGO Co., A Space of Sky with Jeremy Howard Beck, which this is also your second collaboration, I believe,
yes.
correct?
Yes.
And this is a piece about homelessness?
Yes. So that was Jeremy's idea.
Uh-huh.
It came about because there is a great deal of homelessness in Houston, but it's actually one of the leading cities in the country in making inroads in sort of reducing homelessness mm-hmm. and through its Housing First program. And the great thing about the HGO Co. process is that we were able to have two research trips of, the first one was a week, but the second one I think was even a little longer than a week.
Uh-huh.
And the first one was us meeting all the stakeholders in homelessness in the city. So the people who ran agencies and the mayor's office
wow.
and things like that, and kind of earning their trust.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second trip a few months later was us spending a lot of time at the Beacon, which is the sort of one of the main day centers.
Yep.
Where people can have lunch and take a shower and do laundry. And I was very excited about the image of the laundry. And I was like, let's do an opera just about the laundry because it's such a perfect structure. Like it's, you know, I don't know, 45 minutes and you put your laundry in and well, it's actually longer than 45. It's an hour and a half. And we can just, I've never written anything that is actually in real time.
Right.
And what would that be?
Right.
But there were just so many voices and stories that we encountered when we interviewed all these people. And
so you did field interviews. You actually went in and talked to people.
Yes.
And that's
yes.
how you developed the characters for this piece?
Yes. And mm-hmm. so what we did was we recorded about 90% of those interviews. There were a couple of people who said, no, I don't want to talk to you. And then they proceeded to talk to us.
Right.
So when they did, we just would kind of like scurry back into a corner and madly take notes and try to remember what they had said.
Sure.
Emily Wells, who's the producer of the project and she was an amazing chaperone to uh-huh. this landscape. And I believe she is going to actually be directing it. So,
nice.
So she's very, very close to the material. And she's also very close to us and our crazy process or our crazy relationship. So we had these transcripts and then we both like pored over the transcripts and we kind of marked them up and you know, said to each other which stories were the most spoke to us the most and
mm-hmm.
basically came up with, you know, a cast of characters like together that we agreed on that had to be in it for this reason or that reason because of all the different aspects that they kind of reflected.
Uh-huh.
But the interesting thing about that piece is that usually my process is that there's a lot of conversation with the composer and we talk about structure and then and you know, what is the story we want to tell and how do we want to tell it? And then I go away and I write a really elaborate treatment/outline.
Mm-hmm.
And for this piece, because it was all these voices and it was so pointillistic, it was like a collage.
Mm-hmm.
It's not so much the narrative is more, it's lodged in the fact that this is a community and that this community, you know, like, what is it like to move through this city and this world? And the fact is that, you know, the homeless community is pretty invisible to the people who are not homeless. We were in total agreement of the story we wanted to tell, but it's not like a plot-driven narrative.
Right.
And it's not an oratorio. There are three main characters, and they each have a kind of through line and an arc. But it is a piece that maybe one day could also be presented more like in a concert form.
Mm-hmm.
And so I asked Jeremy for his permission to just kind of move things around and see what happened. And he was very generous in saying, sure, go ahead. Mm-hmm. I trust you. But the interesting thing was that once I had done that, and we had evolved the libretto through the libretto reading and numerous revisions, when he actually sat down to write the music, he then needed many, many, many changes to shift to what he envisioned the music needed to be.
Uh-huh.
So whereas usually if I'm writing a libretto to a treatment that has all been agreed upon and signed off on, there will be revisions, but there won't be like, oh, you need to go back to this whole movement and restructure it completely.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been an interesting process. And also he's working much more with electronics and you know, the music of Houston,
right?
More like popular music. Mm-hmm. And what I've heard so far is really beautiful, but there's a lot I haven't
adds
heard yet.
Extra elements. Sure.
Yeah.
Do you like starting with a director on board as well, it sounds like you work with a dramaturg on a regular basis?
Yeah, no, I do very much, and I want to answer that question, but I want to just go back to all, like, actually say one thing about
sure.
about A Space of Sky.
Uh-huh.
And After the Storm, and actually The Long Walk, and a piece I'm working on now with Justine Chen, which is about her family, entitled Seven Sisters.
Uh-huh.
And all of those pieces are definitely communities that I am not a part of. So,
right.
So, you know, with A Long Walk, it's the military community.
Mm-hmm.
In Galveston, Texas, it's a small city, you know, in the South. And the homeless community, and now this Taiwanese family of seven sisters.
Right.
And so one of the things that I think kind of ties together what I'm doing is that I love kind of immersing myself in another language, another community, another world,
mm-hmm.
and listening and absorbing and trying so hard to honor kind of the voice of that place and those people while still finding my own way through.
Sure.
And honoring my own voice. So I think like that is one of the things that keeps, you know, like if I were asked, it's almost any subject, like if I were asked to write almost any subject, no matter how foreign it is to me, I would be like, yes. Because I want to figure out how to find a way in.
So within the subjects that you're writing, it gives you this opportunity for immersive research on your own.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, and discovery, mm-hmm. and but just also, like, I love listening to the way people talk and their stories, and mm-hmm. then how do I embody that in language and language that is musical?
Mm-hmm.
So that's you know, one of the things I love to do as a librettist. But yes, working with directors, like numerous projects that I've been working on now, I have been saying, like, when we begin, I'm like, we need to bring a director on now.
Mm-hmm.
And so with A Long Walk, we did not have that opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
With The Pigeon Keeper, we're working with Matthew Ozawa again, and it was like,
terrific.
We need to figure out who, and this is, you know, we feel like this is our dream team, and we can't wait to, also just because he's so imaginative and And he uses movement so beautifully, and he's so musical, and he really understands opera performers and the process. And he knows us so well. And so that, and then with Seven Sisters with Justine F. Chen, we're working with Aya Ogawa, who is a theater director, and she's like incredibly experimental and unafraid of going to really sort of dark places, and she's funny, and so that is going to be, I'm just starting to write that libretto, but I'm very excited about like getting to undergo that process. And then another director I've now worked with on three projects is Elkanah Pulitzer.
So
all of those pieces are in development. She is just so rigorous in terms of the kinds of questions she asks. But I want to be working with her on everything because she's just amazing.
Do you find yourself drawn to work? I want to talk about some other works, but first I just want to go back to these pieces that we've been talking about. And do you find yourself drawn to work about issues, or do you think there are stories we should be telling right now? Or is it just about the storytelling and its relevancy will find its way? Where do you sit sort of in kind of what sort of stories should be made?
I think that I'm always asking, why is this story necessary now? That I can't work on anything without asking that question. Another piece that also has had a director pretty much from the beginning is In a Grove with Chris Cerone. And that director is Mary Birnbaum. And the questions that I and my collaborators ask about the work definitely shift as the work evolves over time and the world changes over time. So for instance, In a Grove, which is very much about sort of the mutability of our perception and the impossibility of truth. Just becomes more and more profound. And then,
This is an adaptation of a short story by Akutagawa. Who was a Japanese writer at the turn of the 20th century. So it's I feel like so many Japanese stories kind of sit in that perception of truth space. I think it's a topic that continually comes up in Japanese fiction. But sorry, I just wanted to sort of place that as we're talking about it.
That's great. Yeah. And also Rashomon was in part inspired by it.
Right.
The film.
Kurosawa film, yeah.
Yeah, which neither Chris nor I have seen, kind of on purpose.
That makes sense to me, yep.
Yeah.
Someday, yeah. You should see it someday.
Yeah, someday. Yeah, definitely. But, we started it before Me Too, and then it became even more pertinent because there is a rape in the story.
Right.
And so it's just that these stories just resonate in different ways and continue to resonate in different ways. And I'm working on a music theater work with a director, Dmitry Turanovsky, and the composer Daniel Kluger, who orchestrated Oklahoma on Broadway, reorchestrated, and with Daniel Fish. And we are doing something to do with the Bacchae.
Okay.
And we're just at the very early stages, and we have these weekly meetings, and every week, we started maybe a month or 6 weeks ago, every week there are huge new shifts in the world, and we are viewing this play through the lens of whatever is happening. Of course, we have to be careful about, certain things will pass, like everyone making work about a pandemic or, how is it that we navigate what's critical to the time? Or, for instance, The Long Walk, was very, very timely when we wrote it. And it's like a little less of the time at the moment because it's farther away from that war. Like, I'm learning about how, even though it is, again, a universal story about how a soldier comes home from war, you know, forever changed, and the damage that does to the family unit and how they all navigate that and kind of find a way through, really through love, like, which is incredibly operatic. And, you know, all the great operas were also written, or many, so many of them were written about political moments and
of course
movements, but it's interesting to try to kind of tap and mine the zeitgeist and figure out what needs to be said.
Do you think there's something about, I mean, we look at the timelessness of stories, and you mentioned that there are, of course, so many older operas written during a particular political moment that now we view as a universal story, even though they're certainly tied to the time period in which they were written, that we look at that the stuff that passes by now and we think, oh, well, maybe this isn't quite as you know, it's moved away from its time a little bit. But you know, do you think maybe just its relevance will increase the further away it gets from its actual original moment? I'm not phrasing that well, but it's just an interesting notion of thinking about what timelessness actually means in terms of continued relevance of a piece.
Yeah, I mean, I think that as a writer, I aspire to really get inside human beings and what makes any character human. Mm-hmm. And so that ultimately one would hope that would always be timeless. But, you know, it may come in the trappings of something that people see as, oh, that's a PTSD opera, or, you know.
Right, sure.
But really it's about how does a human being heal?
Yeah, I want to, just speaking along the lines of timelessness, actually, can I mention two pieces of yours? And you mentioned the Bacchae also that you're dealing with. That I want to talk about both Dido, which is composed by Mindy Wagner, that was a Don Upshaw commissioned that, I think, yes?
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
Poppaea, which is composed by Michael Hirsch. And the inspiration for both of these pieces, just based on their titles, seems quite clear. So what is it like to write about well-known characters or archetypes as opposed to creating characters out of thin air? And I mean, archetypes, of course, bringing with them everything, all the timelessness that is attached to these characters. Do you feel a certain responsibility to be true to their inherent natures and the stories that surround them? Or do you feel like because they're so timeless that you can blow them apart a little bit?
I think it's both. With Dido, you know, I spent a lot of time with Aeneid and the Purcell, because that is a response to Dido's lament. Like,
sure.
It will be performed in a concert that has that in the first half.
Cool.
But the task was to write a contemporary Dido.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just had to meditate on the meditation was a response to an initial conversation with Mindy and what she was drawn to and what she wanted to explore in the arc of the story, in terms of like how it is one finds oneself in a place one never imagined.
Right.
And how does one cope and remain true to oneself, and you know, what is the depth of that feeling when one felt like you were completely in control, and suddenly you've lost all control of your emotional compass, basically. And also we hated that she committed suicide. And it was really, for me, then it was like a meditation on that conversation and a meditation on what it meant to me to be a woman now and to fall hopelessly, madly, impossibly in love, and how that might destroy a life, but then how a woman today might have the tools to sort of find a way to restore her sense of self. And that journey, I think, is the arc of that text. So I love that. I love having a kind of classic text that then can be meditated on, and like divined and plumbed and exploded.
Yeah.
And I had an amazing experience some years ago working with the director Brian Mertes at Juilliard, where he was directing The Greeks, which is a 10 yep. play cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And he had I was brought on for part two and part three. So I wrote like 25 to 30 songs for each evening of 3 to 4 plays over the course of 2 years. And we interpolated the songs into the Greek text. And then he completely deconstructed, like we used the text, but his direction of the world that he created and what he asked of the performers was incredibly radical. So that was really liberating, because I think that ultimately, if we're doing a kind of radical explosion today mm-hmm. of a classic text, we're kind of trying to get at the same things that those writers or those creators were getting at in their time. That's the goal. It's just going to have a completely different form or tone or shape.
Well, that's pretty much it, right? That we keep telling the same stories over and over again, but we learn things as the years go by, as the eons go by. We
mess them up more.
Well, yeah, there's that too. But yeah. the basic stories continue to be yeah. to be the same.
And then with Popeia, I mean, Michael had already decided he wanted to write this opera that. Based on the character of Popeia. So he wanted it to cover a certain era in her life, which was just as he was divorcing Octavia mm-hmm. and then through their marriage and to her death. He wanted to chronicle her death.
Mm-hmm.
And he was really interested in something incredibly violent. And I know there's been a lot of conversation about you know, all these operas that are incredibly violent towards women. So that was a real challenge for me.
Yeah.
As was In a Grove initially, the notion of like, I'm not sure I want to write an opera about a woman who may or may not get raped, but I knew I wanted to work with Chris Cerone and I knew that this was a brilliant story.
Do you feel you have a certain responsibility actually with having a male collaborator when you're telling stories that have these kinds of events happening within them to women? Do you feel that as a responsibility to tell it a certain way or to be?
Yeah. I mean, that kind of goes without saying. Like I am. Yeah, I'm representing the female.
Mm-hmm.
You know, half of the human race.
Right.
And the thing is that In a Grove is written in 7 testimonies. That's uh-huh. the short story is. And we respected that in our adaptation and that form. And so when it came to the woman's testimony, I struggled with it. And then I wrote it and he's like, this is the most powerful part of the opera.
Wow.
So obviously like we need to do things that we don't want to do kind mm-hmm. of, and we should always sort of face those challenges. And then with Popeia, I mean, my take on Popeia is that she is an incredibly strong, brilliant woman who was, found herself in circumstances that she couldn't not pursue that relationship. And she had to figure out a way to survive as long as she did
mm-hmm.
in the context of someone who was quite mad. And she was ruthless in doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's interesting. It's not a subject I would gravitate towards if I were to write an original story.
Mm-hmm.
But I love being pushed to kind of confront these things that I wouldn't, normally confront on my own.
Yeah.
And yes, and bring something that is incredibly human and that a man may not quite be able to tap, but I don't even think that's true. Like the first music that he wrote for Popeia, Michael wrote for Popeia, was so beautiful, and I connected to it deeply. So I think these conversations about we can't perform these operas anymore, we can't write these stories, and you know, it goes beyond that to we can't write stories that aren't of you know, our own people or culture. Uh-huh. I struggle with that a lot, all the while needing to be and wanting to be sensitive to what is my story to tell and what isn't.
Right.
I mean, that's a very loaded subject right now.
Huge. That's a giant subject right now. And I think an important one to talk about, but at the same time, I get that, you know, it's for those of us who are storytellers, I think, you know, our desire is to tell any story that we feel is an important story to be told, and it's hard to really break that down into what's possible for us and not possible for us, or what we should be telling and what we shouldn't be telling.
Yeah.
You have so much coming up, and if we can only get back into the theater, then I'm so excited for you, because what a wealth of work you have that's once we all come down from whatever this, you know, strange purgatorial year is, hopefully you'll be premiering quite a bit.
Yeah, this year was supposed to be a really big year, moving forward so many projects.
Stephanie Fleischman, I just want to thank you so much for such a wonderful conversation. This, I have learned so much from you today, and it's really great to sit down and talk. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Stephanie wrote me soon after this interview to tell me all of the things she didn't get a chance to say. Suffice to say, you'll hear her on this podcast again in the future, because that conversation was truly unfinished. Next week, I interviewed another librettist who is on fire right now, and who has also completed the Composer Librettist Development Program at ALT. Lila Palmer is a British-American powerhouse about whom Mark Adamo said, "Lila Palmer's writing is exactly what opera needs now." But before that, I'm releasing a bonus cast on Wednesday that I'm calling The News You Need. I found that so many companies are starting programs to help librettists and composers develop work during this time of stasis. And I'll be talking to a number of people who can help you build your skills as a librettist and get your work heard. Stay tuned, and until then, thanks for listening. I'm Keturah Stickin. This podcast was recorded deep inside my office closet in Knoxville, Tennessee. Special thanks to Aurélie Doucet for the colorful logo, Eileen Downey for the theme music, and my husband for keeping the dog quiet. Thanks for listening, and until the next time, stay safe, wear your mask, and keep telling stories.